Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I have learnt to really appreciate in full what we mean when we say time is precious. You know, we think of it as something to spend or to save, like a commodity, but you can't. Time is not transferable. It's not something you can, you can't wait till you're 85 to start having fun times. It's no use cutting back on your hobbies, as you say, and then hoping that you'll be able to go running up mountains in 10 weeks' time when you haven't done any exercise at all. You need a more relaxed and balanced perspective that allows you to find time for everything that you want to do.
Whoever controls time controls people. The insightful words of British journalist, writer and editor Catherine Bligh from her new book, On Time, Finding Your Pace in a World Addicted to Fast, published by HarperCollins. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to unpack time with British writer and journalist Catherine Bligh and ask, what is time and why has it become so complicated? In On Time, Catherine Bligh argues, we treat time as a thing to spend, save, waste, lose or kill. But time is not a commodity. It is a dimension of experience, and in the final analysis, it's all we have. It's our only vehicle to be alive in. So how do we change our attitude to time? And is it possible to stop clock watching?
My name's Catherine Blythe. I'm the author of a book called On Time, Finding Your Pace in a World Addicted to Fast. I was inspired to write this book because I seem to be constantly busy and rushing around. At the end of the day, I found the to-do list was always longer, not shorter. So I wanted to explore why time in our lives has changed and what we can do about it.
Catherine, really well done on the book. I have to say I really enjoyed it and tried to read the book as slow as I possibly could. It was a very interesting read, and you bring up some remarkable case studies in it, and we might go into that a little later. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off. Do you think our understanding of time shapes our lived experience of the world, how we understand the world and how we get through the world?
I think time is one of those things that we take for granted, and we really misunderstand it. We think of time as something you see on a clock or on your wristwatch, or perhaps flickering in the corner of the screen on your computer or your iPhone. What we tend to overlook is that our sense of time is absolutely central to everything we do. You know, we may not be able to smell it or touch it, but what I uncovered during the research for my book was how central our sense of time is to who we are and in terms of our behaviour. So there's a fascinating body of research about people's time perspective conducted by a man called Philip Zimbardo. He launched it, really. And he looks at how your attitudes towards time change your approach to life. And it's quite subtle, really. It almost seems obvious, but actually it's quite remarkable if you consider it. He divides people's outlooks towards time in terms of positive and negative. So people have a past positive attitude, which sounds a bit like a grammatical formulation, but what that really means is you have warm, happy memories, or perhaps you have very negative ones, the other end of the spectrum. And there are people who have a kind of balanced view of the present, who are quite excited and zesty, or quite negative and fatalistic. We all carry around within us different beliefs about time and our ability to shape our lives, you know, whether we can do anything really to make our future better, whether we dread the future and feel that time is something that happens to us. These little shades in our personality can dictate how we behave. And what Philip Zimbardo's shown through research and experiment is that you can actually change your time perspective. And if you make it more balanced, by which he would say make it more positive, really, have a more optimistic outlook for the future, have a warmer sense of the past. Even bad memories can be made to feel better if you feel that you've learned something useful from the experience. You can actually work on your sense of time, and it will change your outlook and your approach to life.
Could it be argued that being busy makes us feel somewhat important, that we have a kind of a greater purpose, and that on days that we're not so busy and we're just moping around, pottering around the place, that we can possibly feel we don't have the same status in the world?
I think so, very much. I think the trouble with busyness, it's tremendously exciting. I mean, goodness, when your phone's bleeping with another message, it's very hard not to pick it up and take a look and feel that something amazing's about to happen. Having a packed diary, it sends a message to you that your life is purposeful and that you're in demand. Who doesn't want that? But at the same time, I've noticed a tendency in myself and lots of people to kind of pack the schedule, or to feel like you're operating on sort of multiple channels simultaneously, to think that that's making you more productive or more important, when actually it can be having the opposite effect. I mean, I'm a woman, I have children, I work, you know, I try and run a family life, you know, listen to me, Mrs. Smug. And sometimes I do buy into this idea of myself as Mrs. Multitasker, you know, as if I'm some Hindu goddess with, you know, eight pairs of arms trying to do so many things at once. And that can make me feel quite good. But when you drill down and see what you achieve when you're operating in a state where you're only giving bits of your attention to everything, or you're so pressurized worrying about how you're going to get to the next thing that you don't actually occupy the moment you're in. This way of approaching life, which I think is being forced upon people, even if they don't necessarily seek it, simply because interruption, distraction, and, you know, fast-moving business lives are more and more prevalent. It's actually quite inefficient in many ways. I mean, for example, they reckon it's about 30%. It takes 30% longer to complete a couple of tasks which you're trying to do simultaneously rather than doing them one after the other. And the problem with multitasking doesn't just stop there. You're much more likely to commit errors. They reckon twice as many. More importantly, I think, is that as soon as you're trying to do lots of things at once, it's a straightforward mathematical problem. Do 10 things at once. If one of them goes wrong, then you're not just experiencing a problem with one thing, you're experiencing it with 9 others, you know. And the interrupted, distractible world that we now live in, you know, our lives are threaded with social media and technology in ways that open up loads of fantastic opportunities. It's really exciting. By the same token, we are now used to living in a climate of time pressure, which is imposed by the fact that you're always being interrupted. I mean, if you do email, which nearly everyone does, that probably takes up about a third of your working day. If you work in an open plan office, which again, many people do, if you're always being subjected to noise, well, they say that even mild background noise, like in a, you know, gentle gossip in a very sotto voce cafe, that will deplete your ability to concentrate by 20%. In so many subtle and insidious ways, living in a kind of busy, noisy, buzzy environment while stimulating and distracting in a kind of fun way also makes it much, much harder to actually drill down and do things. And what we don't appreciate, and again, something I learned researching my book, is that our ability to pay attention is a function of our willpower. They are sort of interchangeable. And our capacity to pay attention, to concentrate, and to stick at something that we may not want to do gets weaker over the course of the day. And the more we're forced to switch between tasks, or our attention is distracted, you know, when your mind is hopping from one thing to the next, or someone pops over and asks if you've got a second just to discuss something, that exerts this enormous cognitive load. You know, it's much harder to get your train of thought back on track than you might think, which again depletes your willpower, depletes your ability to pay attention. That's why operating in a climate of busyness, a kind of culturally driven busyness, it can make you feel important. Your heart might be racing, but it's probably stress rather than the excitement of accomplishment. And that kind of stress has an enormous range of impacts, which we should question, I think. Not least the fact that when you are stressed, your ability to think and to think creatively really does diminish. Yes, you'll get things done if you've got a deadline. I mean, someone who works in radio, I'm sure you watch the clock a lot and you're used to deadlines, and you know that, yes, you'll get the job done when you need to do it. But is it necessarily going to be your best work, or are you more likely to fall back on, you know, received habits, you know, less original solutions? These are the kind of trade-offs we're making all the time when we work in a busy environment, or when we, you know, take ourselves off somewhere quiet, if by some miracle we can find somewhere quiet.
But we all eventually have to face what is our relationship with time in whatever way it is, whether it's dysfunctional or not. And, you know, do you think that if we let go of that controlling idea on time and the obsessions with time...
What time management,
can actually inadvertently and ironically open up time because we're less obsessed.
Yes. Well, I mean, the fastest way to not enjoy the moment you're in is probably to think about how much time you've left to do it in. You know, watching the clock is very seldom the sign of someone having a really good time. And you certainly don't want to see someone looking at their watch when they're talking to you or kissing you. I mean, as soon as we think about time, we are probably not enjoying it. There was a brilliant study I came across. In Harvard, some psychology students came up with a really simple way of testing people's experience, you know, subjective happiness. They gave them an app to go on their phone or whatever device that would, at irregular, random moments during the day, ask them two questions. What are you doing? And what are you thinking about? And it found that, surprisingly perhaps, the things that we think will make us really happy don't necessarily. You know, if you're sunbathing, that might not make you happy. If you're running, you might feel terrible. There's only one sign of, you know, or one kind of guaranteed measure of someone feeling happy. It's when their mind is on what they're doing at that particular moment. So, you know, a constant self-consciousness of thinking, right, my day is scheduled into 5-minute blocks, and if I do this by this point, then I will achieve this, and then I'll have had a good day. I think it's a bit misleading. One of my motivations for the book was not to say, look, we're all time poor, this is how to be more productive and pack more in. It was actually to say, no, let's stand back. Let's question this idea that productivity and busyness are the highest possible goals. Let's see what it would mean to be time rich. And I think you can sort of have your cake and eat it. I think if you feel busy, then slowing down, you'll find you are more effective. I think if you stop obsessing about every minute and start looking at the rhythm of time in your life, you will actually get a lot more done anyway and feel a bit happier.
You write somewhere that when you became a mother, life entered a reverse time zone. I thought that was really interesting. And I'd say that any mother would say to you that their relationship with time changed enormously, if not absolutely fundamentally, when they became a mother.
On so many levels. I mean, there's sleep. I challenge you to find any new parent who isn't obsessing about sleep. And if they do, then I'm sorry, I don't want to speak to them, I hate them, because you just don't have it. And when you're in a state of exhaustion, for a start, you learn something basic, that although most of us live within a 24-hour cycle, the circadian cycle, babies just don't, and you have to train them into time. I think, yeah, that was the moment where I realized that I'd lost a lot of freedom, and a lot of my time seemed to evaporate trying to master new, incredibly basic tasks. Just leaving the house seemed to take me about an hour and a half, by which point then someone would want to go to sleep or have their nappy changed. You feel like you're running very hard through glue and moving exactly an inch forward every day. But it also taught me other things about time in terms of sheer enjoyment. I mean, when you're with a child and when you're not worrying about the next meal and you're relaxed, you get some sort of weariness peeled from your eyes if you see the world anew again through a child. And the incredible joy and fascination of just about everything, that's really fantastic. And they don't need to meditate or learn mindfulness or to be in the moment. That's just what children do. But as my children grew older, simply observing how you sort of try and break them to the wheel of time. You know, getting a child to understand that hurry up, we need to be there on time, is a meaningful thing and worth respecting rather than the reason to have a nervous breakdown. You know, you break them into it, and it certainly made me question some of the obsessions we have. You know, the friends, I have many friends in West London, a lot of whom have given up big, important careers where they micromanaged every second of their lives. And now, unfortunately, they're micromanaging every second of their children's. And just being late to something for them isn't an excuse for a nervous breakdown. But I think children can teach you a lot simply about, you know, relishing the moments, as well as, of course, something fundamental, which is, you know, as you may have heard from your friends, I don't know if you have children, but the days can seem incredibly long and weary, and yet the years terribly short. And that's not just because you're sentimental about them growing older. It's because so much of your time is spent trying to stop your child from doing something really dangerous or memorable that there isn't that much to remember. It's just a little merry blur of preventing disaster.
You write, time holds us captive to paradoxes. And it got me thinking that in a lot of ways, we're sometimes stuck between the present and the past, and then somewhere in between and wondering what the future is, that we're not really completely there within our own time.
Being in the moment, it sounds like such a cliche. I mean, a friend of mine, when I told her I was writing about time, she said, please, 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 can you just do something about this obsession? I'm so fed up with people telling me to be in the moment. I'll just punch the next person. I thought, that's not very Buddhist of you. Because although it sounds like kind of Hollywood jargon, something Gwyneth Paltrow might come at you with, it's actually an ancient sort of aspiration to just be here right now and take stock. I'm slightly irritated by the idea of mindfulness because it suggests that people have forgotten just how to be bored. I think the truth is, human beings, we're all time machines because we live our lives suspended on this kind of bridge between our past and our memories and our sense of what our future should be. So we're always traveling and our mind is always wandering. And the busier your mind is, the more full it is of memories or ambitions, the harder it gets to live in the moment. That's where children have the edge on us, really, because they're not so conscious that their life has to be a story of purpose. You know, they don't think, I've got to make so however many £1,000 this year, or I can't look at myself in the mirror. You know, they can take life at face value and just live it. You know, as a tool, this is where we as a species have a huge advantage over all others. And that's why time is so incredible. If you think about it as a kind of compass for your sense of self, you know, simply believing in a future and planning for it gives you incredible powers to create what you want. I mean, one of the bits of research that I found fascinating and obviously true when you hear it is that the richer and more detailed your memory is, the more likely you are to have a really strong capacity to envisage your future in detail. So there's a great correlation between our sense of the past and our capacity to build our future. And something even more compelling and quite sad, really, was the studies asking people to sort of think about themselves, you know, 20 or 30 years down the line. And people who've got deeper empathy and ability to see the point of view of others are more likely to have kind of warm and friendly feelings for their future selves. And those kind of people are the ones who are more likely to have good impulse control and very likely secure a decent future for that, you know, faraway future, old wrinkled version of themselves. Whereas people who don't really have any warm or strong feelings for their future selves are also likely to be ones with very poor impulse control and live a slightly more chaotic life. I mean, it makes sense. So, you know, it's a great advantage to live in the future and the past. But, you know, to actually enjoy your life, if you're always worrying about the future, you live in a climate of anxiety. And I think that's one of the things that has become much more intense in the last 15, 20 years. I think there's a direct connection between all the demands we now face and all the distractions and interruptions and this kind of fearfulness about the future, whether it's simply that we haven't answered 50 emails or we know that when we open our, you know, turn on our computer in the morning, we'll have 100 things to to do that we haven't completed, simply being bombarded and accessible 24/7 in this whole new way, thanks to our little time machines on our, you know, on our desks and in our handbags, that creates a different sense of time in a way that makes it increasingly hard just to sit still, be with another person, look them in the eye and enjoy their company. The climate of distraction and continuous partial attention is what they call it, where you're sort of monitoring five things at once but never really doing one in particular. That's changing our outlook and our relationships with one another. And I don't think people realise how new and how worth sort of questioning it all is.
Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with British journalist and writer Catherine Bly, whose new book, On Time, Finding Your Pace in a World Addicted to Fast, has just been published by HarperCollins, where Catherine writes, "We are living in a new sort of time, and it is creating a new sort of us. Our instinctive response is to speed up, but we will gain far more from these glorious freedoms if we slowed down and concentrated." Catherine goes on to argue, saying no to technology is fast becoming the greatest time pressure in our lives. I ask Catherine about the link between persistent time pressure and stress and anxiety, and one of her case studies, a lady called Jane, a busy and overworked business executive whose health collapsed due to her inability to slow down.
A woman who'd had a stroke. The thing about her, she had been an extremely effective professional with a very high-powered job. She was one of those brilliant multitaskers. And then she lost her ability to measure time, which is something, it took doctors forever to work out what exactly was wrong with her, because on the surface she was completely unchanged. She was still very articulate. She could move around physically very well. There was no sort of, she wasn't limping. There was no clear thing they could put their finger on, but she had no way of knowing whether she'd spoken for too long or was guessing when she put something in the oven, you know, whether it would be burnt. It sounds like a sort of small technical problem, but she described it as feeling like an astronaut cast adrift in outer space, and that no one could hear her because she simply couldn't plan or interact in a normal way. You know, just to have a conversation face to face, you need to know when it's your turn to stop talking, she said, stopping talking and letting you get your next question in.
Frightening condition. It's almost hard to get your head around it, but I would imagine it would pervade every aspect of life that in a way makes general social interaction to impossible.
Yes, you just wouldn't know when to stop walking, how to get somewhere. I mean, if you think about it, our sense of time is crucial to almost every action we take. So just crossing a road, how do you know how fast something is going? How do you know what point you need to start moving forward? How do you know when to stop moving your left leg and start moving your right leg? All these are functions of time that we don't think about, thank goodness. Imagine if you had to think about it. You wouldn't even be able to brush your teeth.
What do you make of flexible working time and flexible working hours, the idea of working from home? Because a lot of people end up captive to email as a result, because they're always feeling that there's no safe ground, there's no private ground, there's no sacred space anywhere within your life. Because once you embrace the flexible, well, it's all to play
for. It's not even if you don't embrace it, it may well be imposed upon you. I mean, it's a tremendous freedom living in a world where you can talk to 50 people in multiple different time zones, more or less simultaneously. It unleashes vast human potential. I love it. But the trouble with all these freedoms is that we don't feel free. We feel enslaved. You know, if you work in any kind of corporate setting and you deal with people in other continents and they all expect everything now, 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 because affluence breeds impatience. That's one of its key features. You can feel that there's not a square inch of your life that is your own, that because we don't have the same physical barriers between work and home. You know, there's something wonderful about it. Feels like 1,000 years ago, the time when people's daily lives were structured around leaving the office, having lunch. You know, the architecture of time in your life had a steady rhythm to it, and it meant that people had to pause and break and move away. Flexi time is demanded of people, whether or not they do a 9-to-5 or more likely an 8-to-8 working day, because of these technologies. And I think our culture urgently needs to change. I think France is the first country to legislate for the idea that people should have time to unplug. So companies where people, which employ a certain number of people, larger businesses, are not allowed to email them out of office hours and expect a reply. But I think the overload that this is producing, it's, you know, there are numerous problems. A, people are not thinking very hard about communication. They're sending emails willy-nilly because, you know, your words look rather smartly arranged on the white kind of virtual page. And they CC everyone because they think they're demonstrating that they're working. And so you're forced to read all these other emails, which you perhaps don't need to. I think really, when you look at what it does for actual time to do tasks, it's quite worrying. I mean, the statistic I have in the book is 28% of people's working day are taken up with email. But I think that underestimates it, and it doesn't take into account all the other media we're dealing with. If one third of a corporate day goes on meetings, when exactly does work get done? You know, the problem metastasizes because you have all this leftover sludge of work to deal with and you can't get it done in the office. So then you have to do it at home. Flexi time in theory, if it truly were flexible, is amazing. I mean, if you can set your own time for tasks, you can fit them around other things you want to do in your day, and you can switch off when you want to. If that's what flexi time meant, then I'm all for it. But I think we're at this point where we're dealing with the potential and the problems of new technology, but we haven't really got the policies that make it workable and humane. I mean, there's a Japanese word, I think it's karoshi, which it's a concept that death through overwork, and you know, whether it's suicide or just dropping dead of a heart attack. And I think that problem is quite widespread, and we pay the tax in anxiety, in alcohol abuse, depression, and, you know, the rising tide of mental illness. Yeah. But it takes real power and leadership and an appreciation of human capital. The trouble is we live in a world where everyone's meant to feel desperate to get a job, so employers, I think, are taking advantage.
You quote a 2014 poll which showed that over a third of British employees don't use their holiday entitlements. And it was shocking to see how addicted...
I was surprised by that.
It was how addicted people...
I must
people,
be lazy.
People are...
I always take my holiday.
Yeah, I stretch things beyond belief because I actually am a believer in the more time you have for privacy, hobbies and space in your life, the greater the critical thinking.
And it's true. I mean, the richer you are, the more resources you have. I mean, you work in a creative industry, so, you know, maybe it's easier for you to make that case. But let's take another example, student doctors. I love this statistic. So student doctors on a 9-hour shift will see more patients during those 9 hours than student doctors on a 12-hour shift. Because actually having an end stop to the day, it focuses the mind. You know, trying to do stuff within a limited time frame is useful. Yeah. You know, certain time pressures are great. If people are never given a chance to switch off, then their mind never rests. And I know that in my case, and pretty much everyone's, you get your best ideas when you're not looking for them, when you actually take a mental break.
You have 59% of employees check their email while on holidays. This was another survey you mentioned. I found that so bloody depressing. But has it come to the stage where we have to say, you know, put an out in office saying I'm on a silent Buddhist retreat? Because it seems that we have become so obsessed with appearing to be switched on all of the time. It's so redundant.
I think demonstrating busyness has become a massive preoccupation. Demonstrating your presence and demonstrating your commitment can almost seem more important than actually doing your job really well. The trouble is that, you know, a FaceTime working culture, you know, where you have the kind of office where no one dares to leave before 10 o'clock because the boss doesn't leave until then. So everyone's trying to compete to show how devoted they are to their jobs. The reason cultures like that operate, I mean, aside from them being, you know, in theory, good for the company's bottom line, is because it's much easier to rate someone's presence and the time they've put in than actually the quality of their work. You know, it's an unsubtle measure. And again, we've all been traumatized. I mean, the credit crunch 10 years ago when that all started happening. But we're very much encouraged to see ourselves as disposable elements. So you have this kind of one-way loyalty street where you're meant to show that you'll do, you know, give 110%, as they might say, on X Factor to your job, and in the full expectation that you'll be ditched tomorrow if someone younger, cheaper, more energetic and more devoted is going to, you know, they'll take up your spot, no problem. So that's not an issue my book can solve exactly. But what I'm hoping to convey to people is that however unfree you feel with your time, how you arrange it, small changes can help you reap an awful lot more from it. I mean, just simply reintroducing breaks. You may not be allowed to go off for a 2-hour lunch break to the nearest wine bar. That might not be a good idea for you anyway, but as long as you make sure that you introduce some rhythm in the day and some contrast, you're actually going to find it a lot easier to do that hard work and to focus and to also just to feel free. You know, busyness, what drives me crazy about feeling rushed is that I feel I'm chasing that to-do list. I'm like the servant of a clock. I'm running after it like the white rabbit in Alice in Wonderland. And I'm not in control of my time or my choices or even the pace. As soon as you feel like you're setting the agenda, you know what you're doing when, you get it done, you make sure that you're looking after yourself or that you slow down when you need to, you can feel a lot calmer and just that's tiny little shift can allow you to concentrate more and to feel more empowered, you know, harness the momentum in your day instead of feeling like you're rushing and rushing.
So treat it like the fridge, you can declutter it, is that it?
Well, yes, I definitely think that, you know, just as I was saying earlier about in the past, people's days were structured around sort of common rhythms, you know, people mostly went to work at the same time and so on. You can use your own routine as a way of managing time for you without having to constantly micromanage it, which is boring and stressful. So I encourage readers at the end of the book, where I discuss various different issues to do with procrastination, say, or your body clock and how actually we can improve the timing of our lives. And then there's a practical exercise, and it's quite simple, really. Just keep a diary of a sort of representative stretch of time to actually look at what you're doing. You may feel you're terribly busy, but when you see those words on paper, you might just see that you're doing the same thing again and again, and you're just being interrupted and actually not getting much done. Yeah. And once you've got your routine, what the reality is, then you can begin to edit it and to try and harvest moments where you can be much more productive. I mean, I think the best single, actually, there are two things that I personally have taken away from it, researching this book and writing about it. The things that have made the biggest change for me is, you know, finding a moment at the beginning of the day when I've got rid of the children, I'm at my desk, but make sure that I've got at least 10 minutes before I begin. And that might mean setting off earlier to just do something I want to do just for me, something frivolous. It could be reading a book or chatting with a friend or just having a bit of a stroll, but something that just makes me, you know, be ready to begin. That has an enormous effect. And the second really crucial thing has been looking at how to carve out space. Nearly everyone, I don't care if you think you're a night owl by nature, nearly everyone is more effective, has more powers of concentration and a faster firing brain in the first half of the day. So if you can see that as the gold of your day, then trying to quarantine it to make sure you're not throwing away your good morning on chit-chat or, you know, itty-bitty tasks, but really doing the hardest things at that point in the day can have a massive impact. I mean, I probably write three times as much in the morning, hour for hour, as in the afternoon. So when you recognize these basic rhythms in your life, you really can find ways to make the most, you know, demanding job just a little bit more friendly to you and your needs.
You mention a pub in England, which has now got a technology firewall. So anyone who goes in for a drink can't participate in different social channels of any sort.
A gin joint near Brighton, I think.
It sounds like a great place, though.
Yes, exactly. The landlord's dead set against mobile phones because he thinks they've destroyed pubs. And he can't stand it when you see a table of people sitting there not talking, all studying their phones. And I have to agree. I mean, this is where my inner Luddite comes out. I do enjoy my phone, but I enjoy even more other people. So he's got this device which blocks phone signals and imposes that space for people just to talk and be together. And I think that's the kind of policy that we could see imposed in a lot of places to the betterment of all. I mean, I'm amazed that secondary schools haven't banned phones everywhere, but apparently that's not the case. But if someone doesn't start campaigning for it soon, I know I will, and my children are about to start.
You mentioned a very interesting Princeton study. Can you talk to me about it? Because it's very, very interesting. It's quite surprising.
It's surprising and amazing. And it's quite long ago, but it's one of those things that everyone should know about. It took place in the 1970s. So essentially, it was what these psychology students wanted to know, what the effect of hurrying would be on people's behaviour. And so they got a nice, tidy sample group of seminarians, so young men who are training to become priests. And they interviewed these men. They got them to write down, you know, what their motivations were for becoming priests, you know, whether they were doing it for, you know, profound spiritual reasons or whether they were perhaps more career-oriented and they wanted to, you know, be running the world or be cardinals and rather ambitious thoughts. So they got a sense of what their kind of psychological hinterland was, what their personality was. And then they set them a task. And it's one of those trick studies where they didn't really tell them what they were studying. So they were made to fill in these questionnaires, and then they were told that they had to prepare a speech about the Good Samaritan, the famous parable, which I'm sure every listener of your show will know, essentially the parable about someone being kind and helpful. And then they were told that they had to rush over or some of them were told they had to rush over to another building to prepare to deliver this speech. So some were told they had to hurry, the clock was against them, and some were told that they had plenty of time to get there. Now, what these poor seminarians didn't know was that another person from the experiment had been made to lie in an alleyway between the two buildings and look as if he was very sick, coughing and, you know, blocking their path. And the people running this test predicted that the people running late would probably be less likely to stop and help these people. But they also thought that the personal disposition of would have something to do with it. So the more spiritually minded ones would be much more likely to stop and help than the more ambitious ones who all wanted to be cardinals running the world. But what they found was that it really didn't matter whether they were kind, devout souls or whether they were ambitious. If they were running late, there was no way they were going to stop. And quite a lot of them jumped over the body of the sick man lying in the alleyway in order to go and give their speech about the Good Samaritan. But if they didn't think they were in a hurry, then they were far more likely to stop and help. The moral of that story really is that your sense of time pressure dictates your behavior. You know, it has a much more powerful effect on you than you might think. And that's useful to think about now, because very many of us now live in big populous cities, and cities have common attributes. They're much more likely to be faster paced people, and they are less friendly and less helpful places. The bigger the city, the faster people tend to move, literally just walking down the pavement. It's a shift in our lives, and it shows that your mental, not just your mental horizon, but your kind of moral compass is affected by time pressure.
It's frightening to think how vulnerable we all are when it comes to issues of value and agency or whatever it is.
I know, we think of ourselves as ethical operators rather than situational ones.
We don't realise just how much of a pawn we are within the whole scheme of things. Do you think we can console ourselves though, Catherine, that maybe as we get a little bit older, that we will have a better relationship with time and have a better ease with ourselves within time?
No. No, I don't think that at all. I think that our relationship with time is constantly changing. It might just depend on who you're with. I mean, your sense of time running out as you're getting older, is that going to improve your sense of time? Well, maybe it will make you, you know, stop and smell the flowers more often, or it could be just as likely to make you feel terribly depressed about everything. I mean, it really depends on you. I think what comforts me is to know, actually, as soon as you know that busyness and hurry are kind of marketing tools and a trap that can change your behavior for the better or the worse. You know, a deadline is a useful thing for a writer who needs to finish a book. It definitely focuses your mind. But if time pressure makes you disengage, makes you panicky and stressed and disorganized, then clearly that's a bad thing. I mean, it's a much more subtle and complicated equation than you get older and things get easier. Every older person will agree that the years seem to get faster and faster, but they might not necessarily know why that is. And, you know, I was delighted to uncover the reason for that. It's not just that a day for an older person counts as a much smaller percentage of their life than a day for a child, but it's also to do with novelty. So as we get older, we're much more likely to run along the familiar tram lines of our routines. You know, you're less likely, I'm afraid, to do new things or experience new people and have encounters and adventures. And as a result, you're less likely to form rich and detailed memories. You're more likely to glide along on autopilot. You know, as it is, on an average adult, 40% of your day is stitched together by your habits, and the less aware you are of them, the less likely they are to serve you well. So I think the trick is not, you know, you can't assume anything about your relationship with time, but the more aware you are of the factors that are kind of steering you through your day and how intense the effects can be, you know, running for a bus and feeling panicky in the morning is less likely to set your day up well than strolling in knowing that you're going to be bang on time and you'll have had some good exercise while you're at it. Just small shifts can have a massive impact.
But there's also other factors at play, because some people live to work and other people, make their work sure. around their hobbies and living space.
Sure.
But if you've ever done
and
it,
I
yeah.
admire those people yeah. more, I think more. They're increasingly brave souls, aren't they?
But that will affect how you understand time. I did a law master's there a couple of years ago mm-hmm. and was doing it while I was working full time. Absolutely demented. But it really brought home to me that I wasn't letting go of my hobbies. I wasn't letting go of my friends. So I realised what I was doing
what
with my day.
What did you do then? Stop sleeping?
No, got up earlier. But but I didn't just mess about. When you look at anyone looks at their day and all the distractions within their day, you know, you can open up so much space by just cutting out all the fuzzy stuff.
Yes, well, exactly. I think the thing about a lot of the kind of decoy busyness, as I call it, you know, where you think you're being terribly effective, but actually you're just not doing anything particularly well. It is, you know, just a lack of organisation. I think as soon as you really critically evaluate the series of actions that your day consists of, you'll see that a lot of time leaks. I don't think it's a bad thing to waste time. I think it's essential to waste time as you want to. I think my ambition for the book was not to find a million and one new spaces that I could cram more stuff into necessarily, but just to feel free, to feel that I had more time, not necessarily to have to manage it. I think that being more mindful, to go back to that fraught word, about how you use your time is the key. As soon as it feels chosen and it's yours, then you instinctively feel better. It's when you're harried by others or that you just can't seem to accomplish your goals that you start feeling like a failure at life, and that's a downward spiral. So you, going back to you, the paradox of you going to to do your degree was that you actually found more time. You made it more, you realized more from it because you realized what was valuable. It made you focus more.
You have five easy steps at the end of the book, and you have a lovely expression, prioritize peace. I thought that was terrific. But there are things that we can do, very simple steps, aren't there?
Absolutely. I mean, putting time fees in quarantine. I mean, it, you know, the trouble with a world where people are obsessed with instant is that we are more impatient and we get stressed, you know. I mean, it's a world of difference. I was up in the Lake District in the north of England the other day, and people will talk and chat in the queue, and there's no one kind of having a nervous breakdown about it two paces away. You know, if it doesn't have to be so treasured and precious. In terms of the simple steps that people can take to feel in charge of their own time, I mean, I think simple planning. I mean, I talk about tomorrow lists in the book. If you get railroaded every day by the unpredictable thing, you can plan for that. Make your morning sacred and then have a contingency slot of, say, half an hour in the afternoon to do stuff that you weren't predicting or planning on. But if you write your to-do list the night before and try very hard not to add any items to it when that day is come, then you're more likely to get a sense of achievement. I think when people feel like they're always in catch-up mode, that's one of the most tricky and debilitating things. And putting time thieves in quarantine is one of my watchwords. So, you know, turning off that phone, removing the Wi-Fi, or getting yourself out of reach of the Wi-Fi, that's been a useful way for me to get my work done. Afternoons are a much better time to do itty-bitty tasks and you get sort of quicker. So although you may not find it so easy from 3 o'clock onwards to sit down and read contract law or whatever it might be, you'll find it a lot easier to kind of whisk through all those niggly itty-bitty things that, if you allow them to kind of scatter your day all day long, will stop you from getting anywhere.
Last question for you, Catherine. What in at the end of the day, you've written this exquisite book on time.
Oh, you
have some wonderful, I might add, literary, philosophical, theological and psychological reference points sprinkled throughout.
But it's not just about time management. It's meant to kind of prompt people to think about how they enjoy it and to share some stories from some amazing writers.
What did you not resolve when in time? What were you left uncertain with when in time, or something that didn't either sit easy or that you couldn't just fully figure out? Because time, as you said at the start, opens up so many questions, so many paradoxes, so many complications, yet it's also ironically quite simple as well. So what were you left thinking or asking?
Well, what I was really hoping for when I started writing out was a pause switch, just to be able to freeze time. And no amount of thinking or talking will stop it rushing by. So I'm a bit disappointed that I didn't, find my inner H.G. Wells and get a time machine. But I think I have learned to really appreciate in full what we mean when we say time is precious. We think of it as something to spend or to save, like a commodity, but you can't. Time is not transferable. It's not something you can't wait till you're 85 to start having fun times. It's no use cutting back on your hobbies, as you say, and then hoping that you'll be able to go running up mountains in 10 weeks' time when you haven't done any exercise at all. You need a more relaxed and balanced perspective that allows you to find time for everything that you want to do. No, I haven't found that magical pause switch. I haven't been able to freeze frame the happiest moments of my life. No, my children will get old and they're going to turn into teenagers soon, and that terrifies me. But in terms of just facing down the most immutable fact of existence and feeling a little bit better about it, that I did achieve.
And that was British writer, journalist and editor Catherine Bligh. On Time, Finding Your Pace in a World Addicted to Fast is published by HarperCollins and retails for just under €18 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Okay, all that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Niamh McGee, who helped out with this evening's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the cautionary words of Greek philosopher and writer Socrates, who once quipped, "Beware the barrenness of a busy life." Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.